Okay. So today we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 9, the passing away of Vishnudeva, text number 27. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Moksha-dharma, the acts for salvation. Vibhagasha, by division. Sri-dharma, duties of women. Bhagavad Dharma, the acts of the devotee, Samasa, generally, Vyasa, explicitly, Yogataha, by means of. Translation into report by Srila Prabhupada. He, Bhishmadev, then explained by the visions acts of charity, the pragmatic activities of a king, and activities for salvation. Then he described the duties of women and devotees, both briefly and extensively. Purport. To give charity is one of the householder's main functions. He should be prepared to give in charity at least 50% of his hard-earned money. A brahmachari or student should perform sacrifices. A householder should give charity, and a person in the retired life or in the renounced life should practice penances and austerities. Those are the general functions of all the ashrams or orders of life on the path of self-realization. In the brahmachari life, the training is efficiently imparted so that one may understand that the world as property belongs to the Supreme Lord, the Personality of Godhead. No one therefore can claim to be the proprietor of anything in the world. And therefore, in the life of a householder, which is a sort of license for sex enjoyment, one must give in charity for the service of the Lord. Everyone's energy is generated or borrowed from the reservoir of energy of the Lord. Therefore, the resultant actions of such energy must be given to the Lord in the shape of transcendental loving service for Him. As the rivers draw water from the sea through the clouds and again go down to the sea, similarly, our energy is borrowed from the supreme source of Lord's energy, and it must return to the Lord. That is the perfection of our energy. The Lord therefore says in Bhagavad Gita 9:27 that whatever we do, whatever we undergo as penance, whatever we sacrifice, whatever we eat, or whatever we give in charity, must be offered to Him, the Lord. That is the way of utilizing our borrowed energy. When our energy is utilized in that way, our energy is purified from the contamination of material inebrieties, and thus we become fit for our original natural life of service to the Lord. Rajadharma is a great science, unlike modern diplomacy for political supremacy. The kings were trained systematically to become munificent and not merely tax collectors. They were trained to perform different sacrifices only for the prosperity of the subjects. To lead the praja to the attainment of salvation was the great duty of the king. The father, the spiritual master, and the king are not to become irresponsible in the matter of leading their subjects to the path of ultimate liberation from birth, death, diseases, and old age. When these primary duties are properly discharged, there is no need of government of the people by the people. In modern days, the people in general occupy the administration by the strength of manipulated votes, but they are never trained in the primary duties of the king, and that is also not possible for everyone. Under the circumstances, the untrained administrators play havoc to make the subjects happy in all respects. On the other hand, these untrained administrators gradually become rogues and thieves and increase the taxation to finance a top-heavy administration that is useless for all purposes. Actually, the qualified Brahmins are meant to give direction to the kings for proper administration in terms of the scriptures like the Manu Samhita and the Dharma Shastras of Parashara. A typical king is the ideal of the people in general. And if the king is pious, religious,
chivalrous,
and munificent. The citizens generally follow him. Such a king is not a lazy, sensuous person living at the cost of the subjects, but alert always to kill thieves and dacoits. The pious kings were not merciful to dacoits and thieves in the name of nonsensical ahimsa, non-violence. The thieves and dacoits were punished in an exemplary way so that in the future no one would dare to commit such nuisances in an organized form. Such thieves and dacoits were never meant for administration as they are now. The taxation law was simple. There was no force, no encroachment. The king had a right to take 1/4 of the production made for the subject. The king had a right to claim 1/4 of one's allotted wealth. One would never grudge parting with it, because due to the pious king and religious harmony, there was enough natural wealth, namely grains, fruits, flowers, silk, cotton, milk, jewels, minerals, etc. And therefore no one was materially unhappy. The citizens were rich in agriculture and animal husbandry, and therefore they had enough grains, fruits, and milk without any artificial needs of soaps and toilets, cinemas and bars. The king had to see that the reserved energy of humanity was properly utilized. Human energy is meant not exactly for fulfilling animal propensities, but for self-realization. The whole government was specifically designed to fulfill this particular purpose. As such, the king had to select properly the cabinet ministers, but not on the strength of voting background. The ministers, the military commanders, and even the ordinary soldiers were all selected by personal qualification, and the king had to supervise them properly before they were appointed to their respective posts. The king was especially vigilant to see that the tapasvis, or persons who sacrificed everything for disseminating spiritual knowledge, were never disregarded. The king knew well that the Supreme Personality of Godhead never tolerates any insult to his unalloyed devotees. Such tapasvis were trusted leaders even of the rogues and thieves who would never disobey the orders of the tapasvis. The king would give special protection to illiterates, the helpless, and widows of the state. Defense measures were arranged in previous to any attack by the enemies. The taxing process was easy, and it was not meant for squandering, but it was for strengthening the reserve fund. The soldiers were recruited from all parts of the world, and they were trained for special duties. As far as salvation is concerned, one has to conquer the principles of lust, anger, unlawful desires, avarice, and bewilderment. To get freedom from anger, one should learn how to forgive. To be free from unlawful desires, one should not make plans. By spiritual culture, one is able to conquer sleep. By tolerance only can one conquer desires and avarice. Disturbances and various diseases can be avoided by regulated diets. By self-control, one can become free from false hopes, and money can be saved by avoiding undesirable association. By practice of yoga, one can control hunger, and worldliness can be avoided by cultivating the knowledge of impermanence. Dizziness can be conquered by rising up, and false arguments can be conquered by factual ascertainment. Talkativeness can be avoided by gravity and silence. And by prowess, one can avoid fearfulness. Perfect knowledge can be attained by self-cultivation. One must be free from lust, avarice, anger, dreaming, etc., to actually attain the path of salvation. As far as the women class are concerned, they are accepted as a power of inspiration for men. As such, women are more powerful than men. mighty Julius Caesar was controlled by a Cleopatra. Such powerful women are controlled by shyness. Therefore, shyness is important for women. Once this control valve is loosened, women can create havoc in society by adultery. Adultery means production of unwanted children, known as Varna Sankara, who disturb the world. The last item taught by Bhishma Deva was the process of pleasing the Lord. We are all eternal servants of the Lord, and when we forget this essential part of our nature, we are put into material conditions of life. The simple process of pleasing the Lord, for the householders especially, is to install the deity of the Lord at home. By concentrating on the deity, one may progressively go on with the daily routine work. Worshipping the deity at home, serving the devotee, hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam, residing in a holy place and chanting the holy name of the Lord are all inexpensive items by which one can please the Lord. Thus the subject matter was explained by the grandfather to his grandchildren. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Gata Padakamala Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shcha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagamaradam Vitam Sajivam Sagaitam Sahadutam Vadijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Vaita Sivishakam Vitamsha. What a wealth of information. Amazing. What a wealth of treasure house. Grandfather Bhishma Deva, can you imagine? He's laying there completely riddled with arrows, hundreds of arrows penetrating his body, a very uncomfortable position. But he's so transcendently situated, he's peacefully teaching the principle by which the whole human society can become peaceful and happy. You see, this is Kshatriya. He's a servant of the society. He wants everyone to become liberated. He wants everyone to become happy. So there's so many points. I mean, there could be 5 or 6 Bhagavatam classes easily on this purport. I don't know where to begin, practically. We'll just start at the top. So many wonderful points. Wow, amazing. The Brahmachari is mentioned first of all in the purport. The Brahmachari, he cultivates transcendental awakening. That's his only. He performs sacrifices. Getting up early in the morning, taking bath, going out for preaching work. He meant for tapasya, performing austerities, not for just a comfortable life of, you know, offering a few an arti and then just eating and sleeping. You see. He's meant to do tapasya, austerity. The householders, they're given the license for sex, but not for enjoyment, you see, not for recreation. They can have sex for procreation, but not for recreation. Mm-hmm. Actually, somebody asked me a question in the email. They said, what if the grihasthas have some kind of, you know, they're not able to conceive children for some medical reason? Can they, you know, are they denied having sex because they have some medical reason they can't have children? That was the question. And the answer was, a grihastha is not interested in sex life outside of procreation because they're getting a higher taste from Krishna consciousness. That is grihastha, you see. Not even an issue. Their only thought of sex is for having kids, that's all. And they don't have a desire for having sex other than that. That is grihastha. Otherwise, we agree in mating. I think, no, we want to have sex. We want to enjoy sex because we're married. We want to enjoy sex. You see, they're not grihastha. They agree in mating. But a grihastha, his only interest, he and she, their only interest in sex pleasure is for producing children. If for medical reason they can't have children, they have no interest in it. They're not interested in it. They simply interested in Krishna consciousness. And then we get into the kings, the administrators. Nowadays, it's such a, I know I'm coming from the U.S., it's always democracy, democracy. We need to establish democracy everywhere in the world because that will solve the problem, you see. We have to get rid of, what was his name, that... the Iraqi leader, the dictator, established democracy in Iraq. You see, they had this idea, we need democracy, democracy, democracy. It will solve all the problems of the world. But it's foolishness. It's like they wanted to say, listen, we want a democracy in Egypt. And then they saw the Muslim League was winning the election. And they go, uh-oh. They want to establish, in the name of democracy, they establish Sharia law, Muslim law. So the bewildered what to do. You see. But, so this is a fallacy. The democracy is the savior of the world. You see. We can establish democracy everywhere. It's actually, when you have a democracy based, run by rogues and dacoits like we have nowadays, the leaders themselves are just self-interested people. They're just interested in taking things for their own aggrandizement. They're not really in the mood of serving the citizens. So what can you expect? You can't expect a good government when those men who are like dogs, hogs, camels, and asses, they praise those men who do not listen to the transcendental pastimes of Lord Sri Krishna, the deliverer from all evils. So when you get the dogs, hogs, camels, and asses together and say, okay, it's voting day. What are they going to do when they go to the poll station? You see? Who will the dog vote for? The big dog. That's it. Who will the hog vote for? Big hog. You see? Who will the camel vote for? Big camel. Who will the asses vote for? Big ass. So when you say, okay, let's get all the dogs and camels together, dogs and camels and asses, and we'll solve all the problems of the world by having the dog. Camel and ass to decide who should lead us. And then you just get a big dog out, camel ass, that's all you get. Completely unqualified person. You see. Prabhupada said, and who will they elect?
Another pashu.
Another animal. You see. The animals simply vote for another animal. They don't have any conception of human life even mean. You see, the human life means, but human society should be guided by qualified brahmanas. They have no conception. Absolutely no conception. They don't even know what a qualified brahman is. So Prabhupada is very straight about this. He says, when the primary duties are properly discharged, there's no need of a government of the people, by the people. And then they also say in the U.S., and for the people. I mean, in one sense, it's better to have a democracy than to have a demoniac dictatorship. In that sense, it's correct. I mean, it's like they say, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So in that sense, democracy is better than a demoniac dictatorship. But the best thing is to have a pure monarch, a pure devotee monarch. That's the best government. Because then there's no problem. Now they spend 90% of their energies trying to stay in power, It's like in the U.S. now, you get the Republicans and the Democrats are just battling it out, trying to maintain the superiority of their party. And everything they do is for that purpose. They think, well, when it comes to each issue we're voting on, they don't think what's good for the country. They think what's good to keep our party in power. That's all. Almost all our energy just goes to staying in power, you see. But if you have an absolute monarch who's a pure devotee, then everything is just for the benefit of the citizens, 100% to the benefit of the citizens. Of course, if we tell people we need a monarchy, they would laugh us off the face of the planet practically. I mean, they couldn't comprehend that. So Prabhupada also says that any form of government is good if it's Krishna conscious. So we don't say we have to establish monarchies. We don't say that. It's not practical. It's not going to happen anyway. But if they can be Krishna conscious democracy or Krishna conscious whatever form of government they have, then it'll work. It'll be okay. You see, that's the principle. But actually, the ideal government is a king. That's the ideal government. A king, a pure devotee king, guided by pure devotee brahmanas. That is the ideal government, according to Vedic culture. And it will work today, even if the people are willing to do with it. We need qualified brahmins, first of all. And who are that, as I discussed yesterday, that's supposed to be us. Are we ready to rise to that challenge? To be pure devotee brahmins who can guide the king how to be a pure devotee king? Or a pure devotee president, or a pure devotee prime minister. That is the challenge we face in our movement, you see. We are meant to become qualified dominants who can guide the administrators of the country, of Australia, the US, New Zealand, everywhere. Guide the administrators of China, of Russia, every country, how to live, how to run their government in a way that is in accordance with the Prabhupada's teachings. The taxation law was simple, 25%. See, now you pay your income tax, which is a certain percentage, and then that's not the end of it. You have to pay a tax for, there's sales tax, you know, there's this tax and this tax, so many taxes, so many, many taxes. But in Vedic culture, just one tax only, and if you didn't have any income, you didn't pay any tax. Now you can even have no income, but still you have to pay tax. When you go to buy your, go to the store to buy something, you have to pay a tax. Even if you didn't have any income that year, even if you lost money, you still have to pay tax. You see. But in Vedic culture, you're only taxed when you have income. And 25%, you keep 75%. And because the king was giving it all back to the citizens, he was being very merciful to the citizens. If we read a little bit later in the purport, the illiterate, the widows, I mean, everybody was well cared for, the helpless. There was nobody, everybody was well fed, everybody had nice clothing, had a nice place to live, and it was a perfect welfare state. But it wasn't a lazy state where people would sit around and do nothing. Everybody was employed nicely. So, it's a very, very nice thing here. And the next paragraph, Prabhupada is talking about the king is making sure that everybody is cultivating self-realization. That's the first point. The king had to see that the reserved energy of the humanity was properly utilized. Now, one point that comes out in this purport is how everything is actually the energy of the Lord. And therefore, everything should be engaged in the service of the Lord. There's an interesting simile in this connection. Just like nowadays, one of the buzzwords in the society is recycle, recycle, recycle. So the same principle applies here. You see, they say what's come from the earth You have to take things out of the earth and use them in such a way they can be recycled back in the earth. Otherwise, the whole planet would be a huge garbage heap eventually. There'd be no trees, no clean water. The ocean would be filled up with toothbrushes, you know, people throwing away toothbrushes. It just become a complete nightmare, you see. It's like now, a plastic toothbrush, where does it end up? You see, it's going to sit there for centuries. They could make toothbrushes out of cornstarch, you see, that just merge back in. But they don't do that because it's not, they can't make money doing that. Now everything's based on greed. Instead of what we actually need to have a, you know, properly recycling global economy, they don't have it. And the government leaders are powerless to do it because they're manipulated by the businessmen who are greedy for money. The present-day government is simply puppets in the hands of the businessmen who want more money, more money, more money. The whole thing is running on money. The governments are bought out by the businessmen. They're all bought out. They're slaves of the businessmen. They have to do with the people who contribute to their campaign fund. That's what they pass legislation for them. Not for the welfare of the people, but for their own position. So, here's a nice simile, just like, you know, you want to have something you can recycle so it doesn't just sit there and make, you know, an accumulation of garbage, part of the global garbage dump that the whole planet is turning into gradually. So in the same way, you see, when you recycle it, then there's no pollution. Just like all the exhaust on the automobiles, we can't recycle it effectively. It's creating more and more polluted air. Is not recyclable, the exhaust from automobiles in the present situation, you see. So when you don't recycle it, then it's pollution. So in the same way, in a spiritual sense, everything is the energy of Krishna, therefore everything has to be recycled. It has to be offered back to Krishna. Yad karoshi yad asmati yad dahosi dadasi yad. Whatever is coming from Krishna has to be recycled. It has to be offered back to Krishna. If it's not recyclable or recycled, then it's pollution. So the same principle of recycling is there in the spiritual platform. As a world society, we are not recycling the energy that Krishna is giving us. Therefore, the atmosphere is becoming more and more polluted in every way. And the physical pollution, air pollution, water pollution, ever, you know, garbage everywhere in the oceans and the earth, more and more garbage everywhere. This is simply a manifestation of the subtle pollution on the subtle level because we're not recycling the energy back to its source. So that's one point. The king actually has a duty to see that everybody is recycling in the highest sense, that they're using their energy in the service of God, 100%. You see, recycling, effective recycling means 100%. Just like in India, I really like those plates and cups we have in India. The little clay pots, you drink out of it, it's perfect, 100% recyclable very quickly. And those leaf plates, 100% recyclable very quickly. But now they're introducing plastic cups and plates. You see. And I was shocked, we were on Govardhan. One spot there, a bunch of people had a picnic, and there was about like 500 plastic plates just sitting there. They just let them sitting there as garbage at the foot of Govardhan. You see, so-called advancement of civilization. Now we, instead of using the clay pots and the leaf plates, now we'll use plastic cups and plates, and we can just leave them sitting here on the rug. You see, so. All of this garbage problem, air pollution problem, water pollution problem, simply a manifestation of that we are not recycling on the spiritual level, you see. We need to introduce the concept of spiritual recycling to the world society. The world leaders don't even understand it, they don't even know about it. But the concept of spiritual recycling has to be, the whole planet has to be educated in this concept, you see. And we learn from Prabhupada. And it's stated here in this purport today. Prabhupada says, everyone's energy is generated or borrowed from the reservoir of energy of the Lord. Never the resultant actions of such energy must be given to the Lord in the shape of transcendental loving service for Him, as the rivers draw water from the sea, through the clouds, and then go down to the ocean. Similarly, our energy is borrowed from the supreme source, the Lord's energy, and it must be returned to the Lord. So that's recycling. That's the original form of recycling. Just like the rivers and the ocean, it's constantly recycling. If that water was not recycled, the ocean would dry up, you see. There would be no more ocean. It has to be recycled. So in the same way that the ocean has to be recycled to for us to survive on this planet, all of our energy has to be recycled back to Krishna for us for human civilization to exist and continue existing. We have some previous momentum from the past piety of our forefathers. Just like in the U.S., I studied in the university, I studied American literature one time. And the whole beginning of the course, I'm talking about weeks, for several weeks, every single piece of literature we studied was devotional. And gradually that purely devotional culture, the American original settlers of the U.S., 100% devotional. There was no sectarian literature produced from the original selves. It was all devotional, you see. Just like within ISKCON, we have all devotional literature, you see. We're a spiritual culture. The original colonists who came from Europe and settled in the U.S., what became the U.S., it was all devotional literature. Their culture was completely spiritual culture, you see. But gradually over the centuries, it degraded, you see. Now, spiritual literature is a very minor part of the general mass of garbage literature produced from the U.S., you see. So, whatever, we're still reaping the benefit of the past piety of our forefathers, you see, on this planet. The more God-conscious, what we have is the vestiges. The civilization is going on now is going on not because of its own present piety, but because of the piety of the previous generations, you see. But the more we throw that away, the more the society will be destroyed. And anarchy will eventually be destroyed. But if we can introduce this Krishna consciousness movement, you see, this is the only solution. The UN, the League of Nations didn't solve the problem. The UN cannot solve the problem. The only solution to the problems is the Krishna consciousness movement. That's it. It's the only way that we can, this world society can be saved from complete destruction into total anarchy of the Krishna consciousness movement. Because that's where it's heading right now, total anarchy. So now the next item. And next paragraph, Prabhupada is talking about, well, the next point is this is in italic, this is very important, emphasized by Prabhupada. The king knew well that the Supreme Personality of Godhead never tolerates any insult of his unalloyed devotees. So the king would give all facility. He would cover, make sure every transcendentalist was properly situated. He had all of his needs met. We saw this even recently, in recent centuries. Those of you who have been to Mayapur, you know, there that city nearby, Krishna Nagar. You see? You familiar with that Krishna Nagar? In Bengal, near Mayapur, Krishna Nagar, you've heard of Krishna Nagar? Yes? Okay, so some centuries ago, it was ruled by a king, Krishna Chandra. That's how became Krishna Nagar. You see? Maharaj Krishna Chandra, he was ruling over Krishna Nagar. And he heard that there was one Brahmana in his kingdom who was living in poverty, and he was shocked to hear that one Brahmana in his kingdom was living in poverty. He was completely shocked and very much disturbed in his brain. That I cannot allow, how can a Brahmana in my kingdom be living in poverty? He was very much shocked and disturbed to hear this. So he immediately went to that Brahmana. He said, Brahmana, I've heard you're living in poverty. I've come to give you whatever wealth you need so you can live comfortably. I don't want any Brahmana living in poverty in my kingdom. So the Brahmana, he was living under a tamarind tree. And he had a little gurukula there under the tree. The students would come every day, they would bring some dakshina, some rice in the hand. So he said, I'm not living in poverty. My students, they come, they bring some rice. My wife, she cooks the rice. And here we're under a tamarind tree. She pours a tamarind tree in the rice, and we take very nice prasadam every day. Tamarind rice, very nice. Very nice. So what do you mean living in poverty? I don't need any wealth, is it? But the point is, the king, he was so disturbed to hear that a Brahmin and his kingdom would be not in a poverty state. So this was the mood of the Kshatriyas, that every single sage must be well cared for in a proper situation, all of his material needs met, full facility to engage in his brahminical activities. And it also mentions how everyone was properly trained, properly chosen. I mean, it wasn't just some whimsical thing that, you know, the boys were, college students were drafted and sent off to Vietnam to battle the Viet Cong, the jungles of Vietnam, you see. Actually, they tried to draft me and send me to Vietnam. They called me up, you know. But I didn't feel it was the right thing to do. So I used some trick and got out. Just, you know, the Kshatriyas should be those who have that nature of Kshatriya. Not that you take, I was inclined for a brahminical life, you see. Not that you take someone who's inclined to be a brahmana and you send him out to fight a battle, you see. This is not Vedic culture. The king should engage everyone according to their nature. This is the Varnashram system. Everybody is engaged according to their natural proclivity. And that way the society goes on very nicely. And then the next paragraph, many points are covered. I really like this one because people ask me all the time how to get free from anger. I have an anger problem. They write me. And here's the answer. Learn how to forgive. If you ever have a problem with anger, just say, okay, Prabhupada said I can conquer anger. Bhishma Dev said I can, and Prabhupada both confirmed that by forgiving I can be free from anger. Well, how much will you forgive? Well, how much you want to be free from anger? You say, well, I'll forgive 95%. Well, that means 5% you're still going to be under the influence of anger. One time, Tamal Krishna Maharaj asked Prabhupada, how much can we forgive somebody? To what point do we stop forgiving them? Prabhupada said, at no point do we stop forgiving them. The Vaishnava is an ocean of mercy. He will forgive and forgive and forgive and forgive. But the Kshatriya, as the king, he will not forgive. He has a duty to punish, to kill, to put to death, and to punish severely those who are criminal, you see. So the Brahman quality is forgiveness and the king's quality is punishment. You see. It's not that you can ask the king to be forgiving. Well, I've murdered someone and you should forgive me. You know I'm a murderer. No. The king has to punish. So there's a difference there. The Brahman forgives and the king punishes. And then the next one are the women. Very interesting what Prabhupada talks about the women, how they are the power of inspiration to men. They're more powerful than men. Did you all think that these women are more powerful than we are? But actually Prabhupada says these women here, they're more powerful than us. Pretty amazing, right? Normally you think, well, men are more powerful than women, you know. But now Prabhupada knows the other way around. The women are more powerful than the men, Prabhupada thinks. And he gives the example of Cleopatra controlling Julius Caesar. But then the next point is, this is a very important point, that women are controlled by shyness. In other words, a woman has a natural tendency to be shy, you see. So that shyness should be encouraged. That's why we sit separately, you see. Not that we all sit together you know, Haribol, you know, just chatting with each other. That shyness is encouraged in the Vedic culture, facilitated. And that shy quality of women actually gained great respect from the men. Just like Baba gives an example of himself, he was sitting one time in the hallway with Dinanath Mishra, his neighbor. They were sitting in the hallway in their residence. And there was a sweeper woman. This is considered very low class, one who, you know, cleans the chimney, very dirty occupation. It's considered very, very low class. And some sweeper woman needed to get through the hallway. But she was being chased and shy. There's two men sitting here. I can't walk through and brush against these men. You know, they're blocking the hall. So she just stood there patiently and very shyly stood there. And they immediately saw, oh, there's a sweeper woman. Even though she's considered low class, oh, we have to respect. See her shyness, we must respect her. So they honored her and they got up and made the way so she could come through. Prabhupada gives that example of him and Dinanath Mishra. So the natural shyness that women have should be encouraged. Now in the society, it's just totally opposite. They say, okay, now here's your bikini. You know, come to the beach, wear your bikini, and so we can lust over you all day long, you see, and then enjoy sex with you at night. That's the modern day so-called civilization. Women are treated as like prostitutes. They're encouraged not to be not shy, you see. So that should not be there. We shouldn't encourage the women to wear bikinis, to freely intermingle. We shouldn't encourage them. That natural shyness that women have should be facilitated, you see. We should see them as our mothers, and very much in that way, as mothers, they will control us, you see. We are their son, they are our mothers, they will control them. Actually, they will. They will control us. We should honor them as mothers, encourage them to keep their shyness, and then we'll be controlled with them, as Prabhupada said. We'll have to facilitate them in all ways, because they are proper, safe ladies. We'll have to give them all facility. We will not be able to neglect them. Just like Prabhupada and Dinanath, they could not neglect that woman. They had to respect her because of her shyness, you see. So if our Matajis, if they maintain their proper mood of shyness, then we will have to serve them in all ways, you see, as our mothers. So this is a very important purport here about the woman's position in the society, what your proper mood should be. And now the last item. Taught by Bhishma Dev is the process of pleasing the Lord. This is just preliminary for the real essence of it, which is we have to please the Lord. That's the real essence of it. Everything we're doing is simply for that purpose. What is that verse? Yena tena pakarena mana krishna na veshayat sarvavidhi na seda shor etayor ipikinkada. Basic Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1.2.4. That one should fix his mind on Krishna by any means. All the rules and prohibitions of the scriptures are the servants of this principle. And they should be the servants of this principle. If they're not, then they're not considered very important Vedic principles. Just like demigod worship is mentioned somewhere. We accept the Vedic principles which facilitate remembering Krishna, you see. So all these other things that we do, the duty of the brahmachari, the duty of the householder, the duty of the king, the duty of the women, all of these things is simply for the purpose of facilitating our Krishna consciousness. That's what it all boils down to. You have to awaken your Krishna consciousness. And if you don't do that, then everything else is simply shama evahi kevalam. It's useless labor. It's useless labor if you don't awaken your Krishna consciousness. So, now I can ask if there's any questions. Yes?
Are you familiar with example? Prabhupada once said that to one Mataji, you have to be ready to give up your shyness for Krishna?
Yeah, for preaching, that's true. A lamb, a lion in the chafe, and a lamb at home. Mother Mula, my god sister Mula Vakriti Devi Dasi. She was airport book distributor, very aggressive, you see. She was thinking, well, I don't know, Prabhupada, really I'm supposed to be like this, you know. Prabhupada said, he gave her all encouragement to be continue being very aggressive. He said, I was not invited to come to your country, I came in as an aggressor. So he encouraged her to continue to be, for preaching, Prabhupada, when it comes to preaching, there's no gender distinction, really. Prabhupada said they are equally good preachers, the boys and girls. When it comes to the preaching activities, women should be aggressive as anything. When it comes to preaching, it's the great equalizer, the preaching. When it comes to, you know, our and interacting with each other, you know, away from the preaching field, yeah, these principles are there, but on the preaching field, there's no restriction. Women should be, men and women both should be very, very aggressive for distributing books, for preaching, for making devotees, for cultivating people. The women also are brahmanas. We give them second initiation. That means the spiritual master of the human society, you see. Prabhupada is making men and women both as brahmanas. And Brahmana is the spiritual master of the human society. So a woman is meant to be a powerful leader also. And she exhibits the quality of shyness, at the same time exhibits great power. Cleopatra is the example. Is it? In the mood of shyness, she in other words, by that shyness she can actually manifest great power. You see? Not like the men nowadays who want to sleep their way to the top, you see, and become powerful in that way by illicit activities. By their shyness, you see, the woman becomes very powerful. By her chastity, she becomes very, very powerful. Any other questions?
So what you said about the shyness and all that nowadays in our movement that we should not be...
Nowadays in our movement, what?
Matajis are saying they should not be called
Matajis. Yeah, in some circles, in some places, in North America they were saying that. I don't know if they do that here, but there was a meeting, they had a meeting of the, like the North American leaders. They said, okay, we don't want to be called Matajis anymore, and we have all these demands, and if you don't give us our demands, we're going to take it to the media and make a scandal out of this whole thing. They threatened the leaders. So, after the meeting, I had gotten personal instructions from Prabhupada, you see. Prabhupada told me to address every woman as mother. A personal order from Prabhupada. So they were saying, we don't want to be called mother anymore. That's to be stopped. You see. So I said, I don't want to give the name. Who is one of the leaders, one big lady leaders in our movement now. I said, Prabhupada told me that I must call every woman his mother. I said, okay, if I call you his mother? She said, she couldn't say anything. She had to say, well call me Mataji, then don't call me mother. She was a little angry, but she couldn't say anything. The thing is, Prabhupada did tell me to do this. What am I supposed to do? Disobey my spiritual master, Georgia? So, Another situation, yeah. There's another one of the big leading Matajis. I was doing a travel business, Travel Rama, for a time. She called me up, and I called her Mataji. She said, "Don't call me Mataji. Call me. I want to give her name. Call me my name. You know, I don't even call my wife by her name. In Vedic culture, the wife is addressed Devi. You know, the husband never. It's considered too intimate to address your wife by her name." And now she wants me to be more intimate with her than I am with my wife.
Oh,
But I mean, I have no disrespect for her, you know, but she's very dear to me, actually, that particular Mataji is very dear to me. But, you know, these are the kind of awkward things that come and they demand, you know, they want to, you know, demand this, the modern day mood, but want to bring that to ISKCON. So, I mean, so anyway, what else? Anything else?
So when does the shyness come for the devotees? And they are very powerful, as mentioned, that devotees are all very powerful because.
How does the woman manifest shyness?
No.
Huh?
Where does in our movement the shyness?
Where is shyness? We're sitting on different sides of the room. This is a symptom
also,
of shyness. We're not mixed all together.
But that is also controversial.
Huh?
That is also controversial.
Yes, that's all right. We don't mind a little controversy.
Men are standing in the front, women have to stand in the back.
Yeah, we the men and women stand separately, either on the other side or front and back. We stand separately, we don't sit together. You know, we don't live together in the same quarters. You know, there's different quarters for the men and the women. Some of the dormitories now, the university is co-ed dormitories, you know. They share the same bathrooms even, you know. So, you know, this is how we maintain this separation is there. Not out of hate or disgust, out of respect, we maintain the separation. But at the same time, we're a spiritual family, and we can get together and sing together and dance together as brothers and sisters. You see, Papa said, "We are dancing together. We are dancing as brothers and sisters." You see, that we do. We get together like this. We can discuss as a family. We can discuss whatever issues we may have openly with each other. So we're all one family. And we're not these bodies, we're all spirit souls, but because the bodies are there, and because we can be influenced by bodily consciousness, therefore certain Vedic principles are there to protect us and keep us situated on the spiritual platform, that we don't degrade into adultery. Any other question? Yes?
Can we call, address female as Prabhu and Mataji, or is it best as mother to Mataji?
What's the question?
What is best, to call Mataji as Mataji or Prabhu's?
Actually, if you read Prabhupada's instructions, you can take them, both of them are there. Prabhupada said every devotee is Prabhu in one place. So the women are devotees, so in that sense they are Prabhu. But then he also said women should be addressed as mother. So both instructions are there. Prabhupada said we should call them mother, but sometimes Prabhupada himself called them Prabhu. Shalavati Prabhu, even Vishakha before he was initiated, I think it was Jean Prabhu, he called her one time. So, you know, it's not that they're not Prabhu, they are. They're Prabhus just as much as any man is a Prabhu. They are also our master, they're also spiritual masters, Prabhus. But calling them mother is also proper, because that's the Vedic system. Every woman except one's wife is addressed as mother. So actually, either one can be accepted. But to say that you can only call me Prabhu and not call me mother, that's a deviation from Prabhupada's instructions. You see, I have no objection to calling a woman Prabhu. They are my Prabhus. They are all my Prabhus, you see, and my masters. So they are my mothers are my Prabhus. It's like a child growing up in the home. The father is the master, the mother is also master. So to call them mother is good in the sense that it reminds us not to see them as sex objects, you see. To think we're all this Prabhus, we're all one. That can lead into familiarity, it leads to lust. So the idea of mother is actually good. I'm in favor of maintaining the standard of mother that Prabhupada personally told me to do. I'm in favor of maintaining that. Some people want to completely eliminate it, like stamp it out, just completely eliminate it from our society. But that's, I can't do that if I have my order from Prabhupada. And I'm not in favor of it. I personally think we should still call them mother in the mood of Prabhu. This is my mother Prabhu. They're mother Prabhus. That's how we should see them, mother Prabhus. Not just Mataji. Some low class, you know, you're just a Mataji. Like that. Actually, someone who is too much, has too much negativity is just damn much. Actually, he's lusty. He's lusty. He's trying to show I'm a heavy duty brahmachari, you know. But actually, he's just a lusty fellow. Attachment is the opposite side of the coin. Attachment and aversion are two sides of the same coin. Someone's attached to women. Oh yeah, I'm gonna talk with the women. I'm gonna be with the women and talk to the women. Yeah, maybe I can work, be in the kitchen with some women and we can talk. You know, he's lusty, and someone says, yeah, I wouldn't give those women, you know, anything. Just get him out of here. Send him to the farm. You know, don't let him chant in the temple room. Are they forbidden to chant in the temple room here? Huh?
Yes, they are.
Huh? Forbidden? Oh. Well, yeah, actually, I'm envious of you, Bob, because it's better. I would rather chant in Prabhupada's room. I'd be honestly envious. When I come here, I'm always envious of the ladies. They have the best japa spot, and we have to take the second class of japa spot. I'm actually envious of you, Bob. That's a fact. So here it's not an issue, really. But Prabhupada, in some temples, the women are just... There's only one good place to chant, and that's the temple room. And the women just have to go out in the hall somewhere and have no good facility at all to chant their japa. And I probably wrote a letter about that. He said, the women, devotees said, you know, we don't want the women chanting in the temple room. We get sexually agitated there in the temple room. Prabhupada said, if that's your mood, you should go to the forest. Prabhupada was in favor of letting the women chant in the temple room. But here it... You don't even think about it. You got such a better facility upstairs. Much better facility. This floor is ice cold. You have a nice warm floor. Well, it's cold up there too, I guess. But marble is really cold in the winter. You have a better facility at Prabhupada room. I mean, wow. So anyway, any other question? Yeah.
Do these Matajis from North America, they want to be called Prabhus only?
That was the demand they made. They said, from now on, don't ever call us Matajis ever again. We must now be only called Prabhu. That was their demand. They brought all the heavy hitter leaders, women came, and they demanded this of all the male leaders. And right after that, I asked, but Papa told me to... And she was so angry. She couldn't say anything. It's Prabhupada's instruction. You know, Prabhupada wrote me a letter and addressed every woman as mother. Yeah, they were. It was. I don't know what. I don't know if they're still saying that, but wow.
It's already
they're adopting it now. You get these things. Yeah, you get these emails. You don't know if you're dealing with a man or a woman anymore. It is being implemented now. Everyone's a Prabhu, you know. You get correspondence. You don't know if it's a man or a woman you're dealing with. So and so Prabhu, you know. Yeah, it is. They have introduced it to some extent. It's being pushed in our society. Notes that come out of the GBC meetings, I think I've seen like that. So yeah, there is an agenda of certain people who have gotten themselves in high places to do that. It's still going on. But the Mataji movement is going strong also. I'm traveling all over the world and Matajis are still going strong.
Called Mahaprabhus and Mataji, is that to be on the equal level with the men, is that the shyness of the woman or what?
Now, now that's not being shy. So you have to call me Prabhu from now on. They're not manifesting shyness. They actually lose their potency. The woman maintains her the shy position. She has more power than she tries to push herself forward. Like saying, well, you know, my qualification to have that position is that I'm a woman. You know, because we need to have an equal number, to be properly situated, we must have an equal number of GVCs, male and female. Because I notice there's only two female GVCs, therefore I demand, because I'm a woman, therefore I'm qualified to be a GVC, because I'm a woman. That's my qualification to be a GVC. See, that's not how it works. A body, a male or female body, is not a qualification for anything. The qualification is how Krishna conscious are you? So that's a fallacy that in the material society, they think, well, it's called, what do they call it? Affirmative action. Yeah, it goes on now. It's like there was a law case at the University of Texas, a legal case, the University of Texas Law School. They made some affirmative action that we have to have this many people of this race, this many people of that race allowed to the law school. A certain percentage of minorities have to be admitted. So some white-bodied persons who had more qualification academically were denied entrance. People who were less academically qualified, but who happened to have a body, if a minority, they were given the facility. You see. So there was a court case. This is discrimination. You're discriminating against because we're white. You see, they won the case in the courts. So you can't establish your qualification on the basis of having a male body or a female body. That's not the qualification. It's what is your actual Krishna consciousness? That is the qualification for leadership, actually. The person who is leader and the person who has the actual Krishna consciousness, that is the qualified person, that is the qualification to be a leader, a Krishna conscious leader. The more you're Krishna conscious, that is your qualification, not your body. If you demand position on the basis of your body, it's like Jadarani. She asked Prabhupada, she said, Prabhupada, is it true that women are less intelligent? Prabhupada said, only if you think you're a woman. You see, if I think I'm a woman, you see, I'm definitely less intelligent. If I think I'm a man, I'm less intelligent. One realizes, I have nothing to do with this male or female body, I'm a spirit soul, then you're the most intelligent person. Prabhupada said, these women in this movement, they are the most intelligent. He said them. So, if one thinks I am female or I am male, that is less intelligence. So don't try to push yourself forward on the basis of your gender or your race or whatever it may be. That's less intelligence. Go forward by becoming more Krishna conscious. Naturally you become a leader. Yes. What is the question?
So, around the world, unfortunately, there are, like, as Vinay Guha says, good families, right? So, in Islam, there are some couples who don't really, like, strictly follow the fourth regulative principle, trying to become good houses. So, what, from our point of view, should be our attitude to these devotees? Like, should we neglect, avoid, or?
In our movement, in those grahasthas who are not able to follow strictly the regulative principle. So
okay.
What should be our attitude to good?
Compassion. If anybody's having trouble following the principle, we should be compassionate. It's like I counsel many people. I have my e-course with 13,000 subscribers, and I get tons of email every day. And I have brahmacharis who can't follow the principles, you see, who are violating the principles. I have house owners. So I have compassion. So we have to help them.
Or should we condone them?
Compassion, yeah.
In the name of compassion, should we condone it?
You say, well, it's okay, I mean, you know, you're married. That's called condoning. No, that's not correct. Prabhupada said, if one has illicit sex with one's wife, then it's prostitution. If one has non-procreational sex with one's wife, it's prostitution. Do we condone prostitution? No. Some people say we should condone it. But that's not what Prabhupada said. I'm an old-fashioned Hare Krishna. Whatever Prabhupada said, you see, that's what I'm sticking with. I don't go with the vox populi. That, well, now in ISKCON we feel that illicit sex means no sex out of marriage. That's our new standard now. That reminds me of the old saying, when the cat's away, the mice will play. Now that Prabhupada is gone, we can change the principles, we can relax everything and change it. Forget it. I'm an old-time Hare Krishna. And I still live in the mood of when Prabhupada was here, and I'm not budging an inch. Sorry. Whatever standard Prabhupada's established, that's the standard for the next 10,000 years. And I'll continue to keep that position to my last dying breath. Because I know what Prabhupada's established, and I'm not budging to any of these modern ideas. We have to change things, the principles, to adapt to the times. We should be very compassionate. If we say, well, it's okay, I saw one place that said, well, even if you can't follow the principles, you can still get initiated because it's okay, you know, we allow a little flexibility there. No. Initiation means no illicit sex. That's the standard. That means no. Actually, I wrote a whole paper on it. Because I was asked by the Pune temple, ISKCON Pune, to write an essay for the householders. So I wrote an elaborate paper called Spiritual Liberation in Household Life, I think was the name of it, or something like that. And it's posted on a site called ISKCONstandards.com. ISKCONstandards.com, this essay is posted, where I simply went through Prabhupada's teachings and showed exactly what Prabhupada's position is about sex life for householders. All of his Prabhupada quotes is very clearly what he established in his letters, his lectures, and his books. Very clearly established by Prabhupada what is the standard for householders. So if a householder is having a hard time, I give him about the website and read the article. That's it. If you're having a hard time, read my essay. So you know what the standard Prabhupada expects, you know. And once they know, you see, if we condone it and we say it's okay, then we don't empower anybody to follow it. The actual standard. But if we actually educate them that this is the actual standard, now you can know what it is, understand exactly what Prabhupada said and why he said it, that will encourage them to actually do it. But if we don't instruct anyone, we say it's okay, you know, then we're gradually becoming like a Christian church. We're losing our potency as a pure devotional, pure bhakti movement. We're losing our potency. We don't reject anyone if they're having a hard time. Then we give even more kindness if a person is having a hard time. We give even more love and mercy if a person is struggling to follow the principles. So our time is up. Unless there's any one last question, I got about 2 minutes. Any last questions for my last class here? Of course, there's one tonight at the Urban Yoga Center, but this is my last lecture on this visit. So any last questions? Yes?
Just a comment. One senior Vaishnava said that not following the regulatory principles. means putting the spiritual life on the shelf.
That's right. Thin ice. Soon as you become slack and following the principles, you're putting yourself and putting your spiritual life on the shelf. That's a fact. I 100% agree with that very nice comment you have made. That's a fact. Now we got 60 seconds left. So anything else? Yes? Yes. How does one forgive? Well, the first thing is somebody may have offended you, but you have to think, well, how many times have I been offensive to people? You have to take a very objective look. Why should I be so angry at this person and not forgive them when how many times I've done nonsense and people forgave me? You see what I'm saying? How much nonsense I did in my life and I was forgiven. So why I can't share that wonderful thing of forgiveness that I've been forgiven so much for my nonsense? It's like you're an initiated disciple, right? How much you've been forgiven by how much the spiritual master is forgiving you for all your past sins by taking your karma. You see, how much he's forgiven you for your nonsense by accepting you as a disciple. That's the greatest act of forgiveness. He's willing to take your karma, you see. What kindness is that? So just think of the kindness of the spiritual master. He's taking all your karma and just giving you mercy. So why can't you also give mercy to people, you see? So in this way, okay, so we'll stop here. We thank you all very much. Your participation in this Krishna consciousness movement. Make your lives successful and make this mission successful for the deliverance of the fallen conditioned souls. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Nitharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Thank you very much.